Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight for our function at a time of pandemic. I'll have my mask on in a minute, but it's good to see you've got your mask on. Sherry Markson makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. I think it's her third occasion, but this time talking on China. Previously, I think she's mainly discussed politics. Now, she's very well known to all of you. She's been working for News Corp for about 20 years. She's now an investigations writer for The Australian, but of course she's the presenter of Shari at 6 p.m. on Sky News every Sunday, which I watch. Tonight, Sherry Markson's here on the occasion of the release, it's currently released online and available soon, of her book, What Really Happened in Wuhan, which is published by HarperCollins, and there are copies, and there'll be copies available through Amazon and Booktopia, and when we get copies of the book, it has just come out, we'll be selling them here, and we'll be selling them here, and Sherry Markson told me she's happy to come in and sign copies, and we can send them on to you. So welcome also to our members and supporters watching on Zoom. Sorry we can't get everyone in the room, and in any event, some of you are in the state and can't travel. So welcome to Sherry Markson talking on What Really Happened in Wuhan. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Jared and Anne, for having me back here and for the very kind introduction. And thank you all for coming out on when we've, you know, got another 10 COVID cases in Sydney. So for braving that, I appreciate you all for being here. Now, to go back to my journey investigating the topic of the origins of the coronavirus, it was early March last year. And it was before we knew this was going to be a global pandemic, although of course the outbreak had started spreading globally. Within weeks, we would be in lockdown, but at this point, we didn't know that quite yet. And I texted one of my best contacts, just out of a passing interest, a contact who is connected to both the intelligence community and the upper echelons of government. And I asked him, where did the agencies think the virus had originated? And he texted me back, and of course this was on an encrypted app, and he texted me back to say that intelligence agencies suspect the virus might have come from a laboratory in Wuhan that worked in biological warfare. That was this text message early March 2020. And I thought that was interesting, but I kind of moved on, and we were all reporting, you know, on politics at the time, and then we started reporting on the lockdowns that were being imposed by the government. And I mentioned this just in passing in one of my political columns for the Daily Telegraph at the time. I said the virus that senior sources in the intelligence agencies think may have come out of a laboratory, just in passing in a political column. And the reaction from that one line on Twitter, and remember this was March, this was late March at this point, so it was well before Donald Trump or Mike Pompeo or anyone had come out and said that the virus may have started in a laboratory. That didn't happen until mid-April. So just that passing mention in a political column, there were reporters at The Guardian and at the ABC who took me up on that over Twitter and said it was a conspiracy theory, which I thought was very odd, given since the original text message, I'd raised it with other senior officials in government as well, who also said that this was a possibility. Fast forward to April, and my editor at the time at the Daily Telegraph, Ben English, and another senior executive, Kathy Lipari, asked me to lead a series looking at China's cover-up of the coronavirus. And at this point, we were in lockdown. And I think you can all remember, and anyone who has children can know how hard it is to suddenly be in lockdown with the whole family at home. You know, no one's going out. Well, the cafes and restaurants were closed. So you're suddenly cooking every single meal, every single day, doing all of the cleaning and extra washing and cleaning because everyone's at home. That was the environment at the time. And I wasn't quite enthusiastic about leading coverage when I had my hands full into a series looking at China's cover-up. But I felt that I had to say yes, so I reluctantly agreed to do this. Within days of making calls, I had quite an incredible tip, again, from a good pre-existing contact. And this contact gave me two names. He told me Peng Zhu and Shi Zeng Li. And I looked at these people, and my contact said to me, look at their links with Australia. And what I discovered was that Peng Zhu, I have to get the dates here, Peng Zhu had worked in Australia at the CSIRO, at the Australian Animal Health Laboratory, for 3 years, from 2011 to 2014. And then I found out that he was now the number two to Shi Zeng Li in the Wuhan Institute of Virology. So these scientists had become the focus of a very early intelligence agency probe into the activities at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. They were looking at what was going on in this laboratory in the heart of the city where the virus had broken out. This is April 2020. Then I found out that Shi Zeng Li herself had spent 3 months, and she's the woman who's now famously known as the Bat Lady, Bat Woman across the world, you know, famous for her work with bat coronaviruses. Her institute has the world's largest bat coronavirus collection, the Wuhan Institute of Virology. There are only two laboratories in the world that do what's called gain-of-function work, genetically manipulating bat coronaviruses to make them gain a function, to make them even more lethal. I'll get into that definition. Well, maybe I'll give it to you now, seeing as it's come up. Gain-of-function experiments aim to make viruses more infectious and more deadly or virulent, often to humans. The technical definition is it involves experimentation that is expected to increase the transmissibility or virulence of pathogens. I mean, that seems absurd to any of us, to create new viruses that never existed in nature before. Why would you want to do this? And the reason is, the reason scientists do it is they say that it can help predict a pandemic because they can work out in advance which viruses have the ability to make that species cross that zoonotic, cross the xenographic barrier to humans. And by doing that, they can perhaps develop therapeutics or a vaccine to treat it. But it's the reason they do it is it's about predicting a pandemic and hopefully avoiding one. There are scientists around the world who strongly disagree with gain-of-function research. And this has been a topic that has been hotly debated since at least 2012. Because at the time, there was a very controversial experiment where a deadly new influenza virus was created by scientists. And the research was published in a scientific paper. Other scientists said this was like providing the recipe for, you know, a chemical bomb. You're providing the recipe out there for anyone to go and copy it. At the time when there was this outrage, Anthony Fauci in the United States, he's the director of infectious diseases at the NIH, or he's the director of NIAID, and he wrote a paper on this debate because this was a debate that was happening in the scientific community. It didn't spill over into the public. It wasn't something that mainstream media by and large covered, but it was a heated debate among scientists. So Anthony Fauci wrote a paper, which he published in 2012, addressing this debate. And in that paper, he acknowledged that gain-of-function research could spark a pandemic. But he argued that it was worth the risks because of the benefits that he said it could produce, which is that it could also prevent a pandemic. So he was actually supporting this research. He said it was, he called it important, and he said that the scientific community needed to do a better job of explaining to the public why this research should continue. At the same time, there was a group of scientists called the Cambridge Working Group, very eminent, qualified, brilliant scientists who strongly argued, begged, petitioned. There were hundreds of them, more than 500 international scientists are signatories to the Cambridge Working Group, and they begged governments to change the law so that gain-of-function research was banned. 2 years later, in 2014, well, first in 2012, a voluntary ban was introduced for influenza research. 2 years later, in 2014, in the United States, that became a permanent ban for 22 fields of research, which included MERS, coronaviruses, influenza, and as I say, in total, 22 fields. But it included coronaviruses. As far as any US officials knew, this ban was in place. No one revisited it. It wasn't top of mind for any officials. I mean, you could argue that the agencies and the intelligence agencies, you know, didn't have their eye on the ball because this wasn't something that was at the front of what they were concerned about. And for my book, I've interviewed intelligence chiefs like the former head of MI6, Sir Richard Dearlove, and he admits it wasn't, they didn't have a pandemic as top of their threat list. You know, they were worrying about terrorists and various other things. So in 2017, Fauci, under a new administration, had finished a review by his agency into gain-of-function research, and he decided it was time to lift this ban. And after many interviews for my book, I've worked out that he did this in a meeting in the White House. It was a White House meeting, but it was a relatively junior meeting, the Office of Science and Technology Policy, where he raised this. One official described it to me as it just got rammed through. It wasn't raised with anyone senior. They weren't aware that this was going on. Another official said to me that he took advantage of the chaos in the Trump administration to overturn such a significant ban, and no one was none the wiser. There was also a lot of changeover of staff in the administration. So, you know, national security advisors were coming and going. So people who ultimately were there at the time of the pandemic might not have been aware of what Fauci had done in 2017. So the significance was, taking it back to Australia and to that early report that I did in April and May. So I discovered that these scientists who'd been engaging in this dangerous research, and I had no one at the time to explain it to me, so I was reading science papers trying to understand the research they were doing, and I could see that they were genetically manipulating coronaviruses. I didn't know the term gain of function yet. I've gone back recently and read that story I wrote in May last year, and it was a big, you know, we ran it front page in the Daily Telegraph. It was 6 pages in total. I don't mention the term gain of function, I don't think, but I talk about the research they were doing, and I describe how it was genetically manipulating viruses to create a new virus that had no cure, no vaccine, no treatment. I mean, they admit this. Xi Zheng Li was admitting this in her research papers. There is no known cure. And the way they were doing it to find out if it's transmissible to humans is they use mice, but they use humanized mice. You'd have to get a scientist to explain how this works, but basically it's they use human cells in mice to work out if it can be transmissible to humans. Quite extraordinary technology that was developed by Americans, by the University of North Carolina, a scientist called Ralph Barrick, who did this research with Xi Zheng Li. So after this, quite explosive story, revealing firstly the names of scientists that the intelligence agencies were investigating, secondly, that intelligence agencies were investigating a lab leak, and thirdly, that these scientists had been trained in Australia by Australia government funding and had worked here, one of them for 3 years, was quite an explosive story, and it went around the world. As part of my research for that story, I obtained a research paper or dossier by contacts that detailed, that primarily detailed the concerns that Western governments held about China's cover-up of the virus. And the cover-up is such a crucial point, and I'll come to that in a moment. But so I put all of this research in together to this big 6-page investigative piece. And you would think that after presenting such unbelievable evidence of the sort of research that was happening in Wuhan, that this would have been a topic that was investigated and followed up on by other journalists, as it is now internationally, although not in Australia. But at the time, it wasn't. Instead, as you may know, I was ridiculed for the report by the ABC, by The Guardian, by The Herald, and other publications as well that I don't read, like Crikey. But there was a strong sense of that people were attacking me over it. And instead of actually looking at the research that I was presenting, that these scientists were genetically manipulating coronaviruses, that agencies were investigating the Wuhan as the source of the outbreak, and that these scientists had worked in Australia, and there was room for so much more investigation there, instead they focused on the source of one part of that story, the dossier. And they tried to work out who my source was and attacked me for it, linking it to the Trump administration. When in fact, as I said a moment ago, the very first comments that the US President Donald Trump made, saying that there was evidence that the virus came from a lab, he'd only made that in mid-April, and it was in response to a question at a press conference. He never said it before mid-April, but already by this point, it had been established as a conspiracy theory. Now, this is really an amazing thing about how this came to be a conspiracy theory. And it's something that has only been unpicked now by international journalists. And it was only something that really I discovered when I was writing the book. And it was such an awakening and eye-opening discovery to me when I realized this when I was writing the book, is that the Chinese narrative had taken hold from day one. Everything we knew was Chinese disinformation. And it wasn't just a cover-up by China of the virus, which is well established, and I'll get to that in a minute, but it was a cover-up of scientists. It was a shutdown of scientists, of scientific journals, and then through that of the media, because the media trusted the scientists. So what happened was, February 6, before any of us even realized that this was going to be a global pandemic, there was a scientist called Peter Daszak. He's the president of a not-for-profit group based in New York called the EcoHealth Alliance. He had worked with Xi Zheng Li and the Wuhan Institute of Virology for 15 years. His name is literally next to Xi Zheng Li's on all of their scientific on many of their scientific papers, dozens of papers. He's a co-author. And he would go bat sampling with her. That's what EcoHealth did. It went bat sampling. Not only had he worked with her for 15 years, but he had funded the Wuhan Institute of Virology. The funding was funneled from the NIH. So the money he was giving to the Wuhan Institute was a subgrant. In total, the EcoHealth Alliance has had $60 million in US grants. $60 million. And some of that, about $600,000 that we know of, was funneled through to the Wuhan Institute of Virology. We do not know where the rest of the $60 million has gone. That is not information that is in the public domain at this point. The point is that Peter Daszak, a highly respected scientist, had worked with Wuhan Institute of Virology for 15 years and had funded their work such a crucial point, a co-author on their paper. On January 1st, before the coronavirus had even been reported in the newspapers, the first New York Times, Wall Street Journal, the Times in London report, that was all on January 7. January 6 online, January 7 in the papers. On January 1, Peter Daszak tweets that there's a virus and China's going to do an excellent job looking after, dealing with it. Eddie Holmes, the New South Wales Scientist of the Year at University of Sydney here, he tweets back saying he agrees China CDC will do an excellent job dealing with this outbreak. So Peter Daszak then, on February 6, 2020, he sends emails to other esteemed scientists around the world saying that there's this conspiracy that's taking hold that the virus came from a lab, and asking them to be signatories on a letter that he was going to publish in The Lancet, say supporting their Chinese colleagues and saying that this is misinformation. Again, I stress, this is February 6. Trump hasn't said a word and doesn't say a word until mid-April, so this is not responding to Trump. So he sends these emails, go back and forth, there's dozens and hundreds of pages of these emails, and in the end the scientists agree to sign this letter, and Peter Daszak says in the letter that he wants to keep his involvement quiet so as not to muddy the waters, I think is his exact phrase. And this letter is published in The Lancet, one of the most distinguished scientific medical journals internationally, saying that it is misinformation, that it is a conspiracy to suggest that the virus originated in a lab and that there's no evidence for it. The problem is twofold. One, there was no evidence that they were able to present to show that the virus had a natural origin. So it was an opinion piece, if you like. Secondly, there were no conflicts of interest disclosed. None. And no one was aware that Peter Daszak was behind the letter. No one was even aware that he worked with the Wuhan Institute of Virology. I mean, it's like China, you know, it's like the Wuhan Institute of Virology itself. It's almost like China propaganda, given the close relationship he had with them. None of this would be discovered until these emails emerged under a Freedom of Information Act in November 2020 by an amazing not-for-profit group called the US Right to Know. The head of it is Gary Ruskin. I've had him on my show a couple of times on a Sunday night, so you might have seen him be interviewed there. He doesn't have political affiliations. He just put in a bunch of FOI requests and he uncovered these emails, which showed Peter Daszak's the fact that he was behind this early letter. Then even worse, the WHO investigation, and I'm giving away a little bit here, but that's bound to happen. When the WHO investigation finally took place, the US suggested three names for people that they would like to be involved in the WHO. Those individuals were rejected. And instead, the only US citizen to be included on that WHO team, Peter Daszak. In Wuhan, when they're going about the investigation, oh, another point here. One of my amazing researchers for my book, Liam Mendes, is sitting at the back of the room here. And Liam did some amazing work. He analyzed all of Peter Daszak's tweets, and he found that there were about 100 tweets where he mentioned the word conspiracy. So this whole time, Peter Daszak was prolific in the media and in the traditional media and on social media, saying that it was a conspiracy to suggest that the virus may have originated in a lab. Even people who said it was a line of inquiry, which, by the way, is all my reporting has ever said, is that it's a possibility, is that intelligence agencies were investigating it as a possibility. You know, none of us know for sure where the virus originated. So anyway, when he's as part of the World Health Organization investigative team in Wuhan, they spend just 3 hours at the laboratory out of a 2-week trip. And in those 3 hours at the laboratory, they talk about the conspiracy of a lab leak comes up, and they decide they have to address the conspiracy because of all the media attention. And he has admitted subsequently that he did not ask the Wuhan Institute of Virology about their missing virus database, a database that could hold some 19,000 bat samples that they collected and some 3,000 coronavirus bat samples. It had suddenly disappeared. It had gone offline, missing, in September 2019, September 12, 2019. It was taken off the internet. Xi Zhengli claims it was subject to hacking attempts, but this has never been proven, and there's been no explanation given for why all this time later it has never been re-uploaded and never been provided to any investigative agencies. So Peter Daszak and the World Health Organization do not even ask, and he's admitted this, they do not even ask for access to these virus samples. There couldn't be a more crucial piece of evidence that the World Health Organization should look for than the virus samples. What viruses does the Wuhan Institute of Virology hold? This is, as I said, the institute that has the largest bat coronavirus database in the world. What virus databases does it hold? Where are the list of the full 3,000 bat coronaviruses that they've collected? They didn't ask. It was a whitewash of an investigation, and yet all the media reporting directly afterwards, or most of it, just said the World Health Organization found it was extremely unlikely to have come from a lab. There has been no adequate investigation. But you're starting to get an idea of how Chinese disinformation, how the Chinese narrative took hold from the start, because some of the figures who'd been intimately involved with the Wuhan Institute of Virology played such a crucial role in shaping the public narrative by using the very institutions we trust. If you can't trust scientists, if you can't trust The Lancet, what can you trust? You know, none of us. This is why the media got it wrong, because they were listening to something that was published in The Lancet. They were listening to credible, supposedly credible scientists, not knowing that there were such egregious conflicts of interest. And the fact his conflicts of interest, as I say, have only been unpicked slowly after all of this time. And step by step, as more evidence emerges, we've started to realize this. A second crucial part of why the narrative took hold the way it did is that there were scientists who did their own analysis of the virus, SARS-CoV-2, that's the virus behind COVID-19, and they noticed there were unusual things about it that might not point to a natural origin, that might suggest a laboratory construct, or that it had been the subject of gain-of-function genetic manipulation. One of those scientists, you probably know this already, is our very own Nikolai Petrovsky from Flinders University in Adelaide. He's a professor. He wrote a paper in May last year that showed that SARS-CoV-2 has a higher binding affinity to humans than to any other animal. So that means it's more infectious to humans than to bats even, or pangolins, or horse, or snake, or rat, or mouse. He looked at any credible mammal, and he did this using an Oracle supercomputer that he repurposed for this exercise, and it meant he could run the modeling to see which mammal, which host is infected, you know, which host the virus infects the most. And this was such a surprising finding for him, to find that the spike protein of SARS-CoV-2 had a higher binding affinity to human ACE2 receptors, sorry to get a bit technical, but I may as well use the correct terms, than to the receptors of any other animal. And this pointed to the fact, as he says, that it could have been a recombination event in nature where two viruses infect an animal host at the same time and combine to produce a new virus. Or that same recombination event could have happened in a cell culture in a laboratory. So he produced this paper, he did it. He's a very calm individual. He's definitely not conservative. He's been railing against the Morrison government for not funding his vaccine candidate for COVID-19. he was led by the science. And this project he did with a colleague at La Trobe University. These are not political figures. They were led by the science. They thought there might be difficulty publishing it. They had no idea just how hard it would be. It's only early this month, June 2021, when the entire public consensus and narrative has changed, that his paper has finally been accepted into a prestigious scientific journal. Extraordinary, 13, 14 months later. So he couldn't get it published anywhere. So after trying all the credible outlets that just rejected it, but he says it was like political dynamite to suggest at the time that it might have been a laboratory origin. So he tried the preprint service. Preprint servers are where, this is the very nature, the very reason preprint servers exist, is to publish scientific papers to get the science into the public domain while it's going through the peer review process. Even the preprint servers rejected his paper, and they rejected any other paper that questioned a natural origin. For my book, I asked the editors-in-chief of those preprint servers, or the CEOs, why they would do this. Because in doing that, in rejecting scientific papers that questioned a natural origin, they were playing into China's narrative and China's propaganda. And if I find the right page, which I have, I will read you the response. The co-founder of BioRxiv and MedRxiv, John Inglis, he admitted to me that they had refused to publish a small proportion of scientific papers related to the origin of COVID-19. He said a small proportion of manuscripts may have harmful consequences if posted in the open on a preprint server before peer review. He then spoke about, he said, for example, challenges to the safety of standard medical procedures, assertions about substances, or encouragements to self-medicate. He said, because of the frantic pace of new information about the novel coronavirus and overwhelming public interest, we applied this pre-existing do no harm policy that they had used for those other papers. They applied it to studies about the virus. He said, this is not a judgment of the investigations concerned, simply a recognition that preprint screening must be limited and fast, and certain manuscripts, a very small proportion, in our view, should have the more concentrated, expert, and detailed assessment before being distributed. And therefore, we declined with that explanation to the authors. So as you can see, as you start to investigate this topic, the cover-up, the suppression of science, the suppression of credible scientists who looked at the genetic sequence, the genome of this virus, and said, it looks like it could be a laboratory construct because it was perfectly designed or perfectly adapted. It was ready-made adapted to infect humans, and there was no other host that had a greater binding affinity. We haven't even got to the furin cleavage site, which I don't think we're going to have time for, but there are other unusual aspects of the virus as well, like the furin cleavage site. But these scientists were suppressed, and instead, the scientists that had 15 years worth of relationships with the Wuhan Institute of Virology, financial ties with the Wuhan Institute of Virology, were allowed to freely publish their propaganda, even though it lacked in any evidence and amounted to nothing more than an opinion piece. Should I keep going, or do you need me to stop after?
Stop when you feel you want to stop.
Well, I mean, I can talk for a very, very long, very long time.
Let's stop there.
Okay. I'm happy to do questions, though, as well.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So many thanks to Sherry Marks. And so, as I said, the book's now up on sale, but we'll have signed copies here when it gets to Australia, and Sherry will sign them and we'll sell them both to people here tonight and to people on Zoom, and they'll go up on Anne's mail outs and whatever. And so we can...
If people want to order them tonight...
If you want to order them tonight, we'll take your orders. Anne will take your
names.
Orders.
Okay.
We'll take your names.
There it's,
we're very good at taking names here.
What's on Booktopia and Amazon as well.
Yeah. Okay, so now we come to questions and discussion, and I should point out that you're at the Sydney Institute before you became internationally famous, you see, as a reporter.
I was with Aaron Patrick on the politics.
He was.
On the Morrison government.
That's right. You from News Corp, Aaron from Nine.
And Aaron's on my show every Sunday night.
He is. He's on it. I watch it, so he's on about 10 to 7, right? Thereabouts.
Hopefully a bit earlier, unless we're running late.
Okay.
Yeah.
Court decision. Just go back to the response, because as someone who's not a scientist reading your early stuff and the Telegraph and continued into the Australian and in on Sky, it always seemed to be reasonable. I had no idea whether you were correct or not. You didn't say you were correct. You said it was a reasonable scenario, which has now turned out to be a bit more than that. But going back, as you know, Fox News has a media program called Media Buzz, where people come on, give differing views, they discuss and analyse things. Here we have Media Watch on the ABC, and as I recall, back in May last year, May 2020, Paul Barry essentially said that you're a conspiracist. Pretty well said that. Pretty well dismissed it with ridicule. Close to that. Since then, the international following of this has changed dramatically, and what you were saying a year ago is now being widely discussed throughout the Western world. Paul Barry's made no correction. Does that worry you at all?
It doesn't worry me, but I think it is worth noting that there were two full, well, near a good chunk of two Media Watch episodes last year, and some more this year, were dedicated to attacking me. And last year, his point was that virologists all said it couldn't have come out of a lab, and he could never have the sources that I have, and I reported accurately that intelligence agencies were investigating this. And so everything I reported was factual, but I think anyone who knows me or my reporting, my colleagues, would have been able to read the work and seen that it was, you know, accurate and credible, and there was nothing wrong with it. But I suppose for ABC viewers who maybe don't know me or don't know my reporting, that might have damaged my reputation and damaged my credibility, and probably people did think I was a conspiracy theorist, and it did go to tarnishing, you know, my reputation in their eyes. Obviously, that was not something that would bother me or would ever bother me. I forged on. I wasn't dissuaded from reporting on it. But, you know, it is worth noting that he is a senior male and I'm a female, and the left always criticise, you know, people who attack Louise Milligan or women on the left, but the left have no problem completely ridiculing and humiliating and bullying women at News Corp. I'm not a conservative. I'm a journalist first and foremost. Of course, I don't have ideological leanings. I'm a journalist. But, you know, working for News Corp, they have no problem attacking you even if your reporting is sound.
There's a question here. You take your mask off to ask the question. That's fine.
Thanks, Jared. Sherry, thank you so much for your work. What is going on here? We seem to be entering an age in which critical inquiry is just not permitted anymore. Brett Weinstein, I think, calls it an emergent phenomenon. But is it that's going on, or is it purely money? Because that's the other angle that is quite clear.
I think you're right. I think it's the ideology. And you look at, you know, the censorship on this topic. I mean, Facebook has only just lifted their ban on this content. Isn't that extraordinary? Something that our agencies and government officials thought was genuine, you know, enough that Maurice Payne called for an inquiry into it last April, and yet Facebook banned content. Like, that's censorship of any thinking on any topic that doesn't fit with the narrative is so dangerous. How can we live in a society where our discussions, where our investigations, where our freedom to question what we're fed is censored? It is so, there is nothing more disturbing as a trend that has emerged in recent times, I think.
down the back, Glenn.
Thanks. Hi, Sharon. Glenn Milne. Congratulations on your work, and thank you. Just the briefest of prefaces, Jared. Yes, I agree with you entirely. As a veteran of News Corp, the culture wars, the media culture wars, have dominated this issue to an extraordinary extent, and truth has been the casualty. I just had two questions. You mentioned Peter Daggett's name was put forward as the WHO representative on the investigation. You said three other names went forward, but he was the final nominee. But you didn't actually say how that happened, and I wondered whether you had an explanation for that. And secondly, I wonder also whether you believe that the issue of Chinese money and universities has infected this this issue at a scientific level.
Firstly, just on the preface point, Glenn Milne was my mentor in Canberra. He was political editor at the Sunday Telegraph, and I was his number two back when I was in my early 20s. And I always looked up enormously to Glenn, and he was able to break the biggest scoops in the entire country, and I always hoped I'd one day be able to do that. The first question, I don't know how that happened. I wish I knew. It was enough to find out the names, which I was able to do so, the three names that the US put forward. I was able to track them down. But what happened? The suspicion is that China had to veto the names, but I don't have proof for that. I would love to know what happened. The second part, I think there's an enormous separate issue with Chinese funding in our universities, in our university sector. And I've done some reporting on that through the 1,000 Talent Program, Chinese government recruitment programs. It's an absolutely massive issue. I don't even, James Patterson has started with an intelligence inquiry to look at this topic. But how you unpick that, why it's so grave, I'll be so brief, but why it's so grave is because these joint projects mean that Chinese universities have access to our research and our intellectual property. And that was fine even 10 years ago. But the problem is now under Xi Jinping's civil-military fusion, where all the universities are now coming under, at some level, the control of the PLA, even the Chinese scientists don't have control over how their research could be, repurposed for nefarious purposes, dual-use technology. And when you start to look into some of the partnerships, particularly under the 1,000 Talent Program, this is a Chinese government recruitment program where they pay salaries and perks for researchers in Australia and US and New Zealand, everywhere, they end up patenting the research that was developed in Australian universities with Australian research funding. So an enormous issue.
You went down the back, and then I've got a question here.
Yes, thank you. Do you agree that WHO was very slow to react from the very beginning and didn't do a real good job? Thank you.
Yes, that's not even something to have an opinion on. That's just factual. They did, the WHO, Australia declared that this was a pandemic a fortnight before the WHO did. I've interviewed a lot of people for the book, and there's differing views. Some people think Tedros is very weak. Other people think China just wouldn't let the WHO in. So, your opinions can fall on either side of that. But, I personally think it's both. China wasn't providing the access, but he should have been stronger, and he should have come out publicly and said, China's not giving the access. Instead, what he did was he came out and said, and by the way, Donald Trump said this as well, they both came out and said, China is being transparent. China is handling this well. It couldn't have been further from the truth.
So I got a question from Zoom from Arda Lichter, who says, did Dr. Fauci have any role in the Wuhan Institute of Virology?
So when Fauci lifted the ban on gain-of-function research in the US in 2017, that's one thing. But even while the ban was in place in the US, and this is such an important point, the US money through this subgrant was still going to the Wuhan Institute of Virology. So they were still doing this research in China. And Fauci, in many interviews, has said they were not doing gain-of-function research. It is not true. We've literally had their scientific papers analyzed by scientists. It's not even a doubt. They were conducting gain-of-function research. And in one interview, Fauci does explain why he chose China. And I've broadcast this now twice on my Sunday night show because I just think it's so extraordinary that he admitted this. He said the reason they funded the research in China was to avoid an outbreak in Hoboken, New Jersey.
What?
He knew there were risks with this research and he was funding it in China deliberately. This is an on-camera interview. I mean, you know, if you missed my show, it's on YouTube, this particular, Google my name in YouTube and you'll find this clip. It is so outrageous that he knew there was a risk of an outbreak and that's why he funded it in China.
Thank you. Charles Nightingale, the research that you've done has been amazing and obviously the narrative has changed because of that and certain other things that have been happening around the world. So what do you think is the tipping point that allowed that to happen and where do you think it's going?
Thank you for the very generous compliment. I think this never would have happened if Trump was still in power. I think because Trump said in April last year that there was evidence that the virus came from a lab and that, you know, there is evidence, not definitive, but there's circumstantial and scientific evidence that it may have come from a lab. Because he said those words because he was trying to blame China for the outbreak, for domestic political purposes in an election year, that meant that, you know, the wider media community in the US didn't want to give him any way out, so they didn't want to count, you know, consider this possibility. So after the change of administration, that meant that suddenly the journalists and the scientists could revisit this topic again and say, hey, this might be legitimate. Also Biden himself, you know, he was looking at the same intelligence that Trump and Pompeo were looking at, and he can't dismiss it. Like it's obviously at least it's obviously solid, and at least solid enough to call for an investigation, and which he did in, I think, May this year. And he acknowledged that none of the intelligence community has any strong, you know, views about where this came from. One part, a third of it, of the agencies think it's more likely to have come from a lab, two thirds more likely to have natural origin. But I think he said each of those agencies didn't hold that with a strong conviction. The problem was, and I won't speak for too long because I'm sure there's more questions, but the problem was that the intelligence agencies hadn't been tasked to continue investigating this. So there's a lot of, and they've admitted this, and New York Times even reported this, that there's a lot of untapped material that hasn't even been examined. And this is a whole nother fascinating story as well. The State Department officials who were investigating this, you know, felt like the intelligence agencies weren't being very cooperative with them, and that, you know, I go into this a lot in the book. This is a big theme of the book because there's information that was there and it was hard to get it.
Right, there's a question down there.
Sorry, Meredith Ward, I'm a doctor and a scientist. I read your article when it first came out and you shouldn't have been shouted down because it was definitely plausible. As you said, there was no definitive evidence, but it was definitely a discussion point. I think that one of the reasons the establishment was so anti this being discussed was the thought of racism and the fact that Chinese people in the community might have been experiencing racism as a result of the Chinese government having been blamed for coronavirus. I had some experiences very early on in around February, March, where we were having telephone link-ups with doctors in China, and the doctors from Wuhan were censored. So we were unable to communicate with anybody in the epicentre. I'd love to know your thoughts on how China has played this. What I find is that China has played the role of being very globally philanthropic and helpful, but when it came to the epicentre and the origins, there was an enormous contrast with the information and help that they were willing to release.
Yeah, that's so interesting that you say that because, you know, the doctors in Wuhan were so many of them were desperate to spread the word about the virus in the early days and what was happening, and they were just shut down. I mean, worse than shut down, they were arrested. 8 of them were arrested. And of course, one famously dying and he became a hero. But, you know, there were so many other people who tried to spread the word, not just doctors, but activists and citizen journalists, who some of them, you know, still haven't reappeared. They've been missing ever since. So China's cover-up was so egregious. And again, that raises the question, what did they have to cover up? Why has it been so... And in terms of their aid, I mean, I think many geopolitical experts you'll speak to say that China has sought to take strategic advantage of the pandemic. So not only did they cover it up and therefore make the deliberate decision for it to spread internationally because they could have shut down flights, they objected to our travel bans, you know, and that's something that's forgotten as well. They objected to our travel ban. So that was a deliberate decision to allow it to spread around the world and cover up the information and news about the virus. But then they sought to take advantage of it through first, mask diplomacy or personal protective equipment diplomacy, and now vaccine diplomacy, which is something that's been of huge concern. Yeah.
Hi, Sherry. Thanks for all your work. The Pune guy that nominated, America, he was part of the team that went to China.
Yes.
Including the scientists from South Australia.
Yeah.
Now, you said that he didn't ask the question when he was in Wuhan about the missing information. Did anybody else on that team ask that question, and why not?
None of them asked it. So where he admitted that he didn't ask it was in a Zoom conference call with a few other investigators, and he said, we didn't ask. He said, we didn't ask for it.
Do you think that was deliberate?
Yes. I think it shows that they weren't making any serious attempt. I mean, these were his colleagues, you know, his colleagues. He's worked alongside them. His name is on the paper as well. If the virus came from the lab, then, I mean... You'd have to think there would be in any way serious investigation about the work they were doing, the research they were doing. Not to say it was in any way nefarious. It could be completely, as I said at the start, you know, they were trying to predict a pandemic. Could be for very noble causes. But the point is that facility, and it might not have just been her research, there were many laboratories in the Wuhan Institute of Virology, and there was another laboratory on the same compound as well called the Wuhan Institute of Biological Products. So, but the point is, this was not a rigorous attempt to investigate what had gone on, and the virus database is such a crucial piece of evidence for World Health Organization investigators that none in the team even asked to see it. That just shows that how ridiculous this investigation was. I mean, it shouldn't be taken seriously by anybody.
I just wanted to ask, this is obviously a serialised sort of story.
Yes.
We all want to know what happens next. but apart from what happens next in the investigation, is if we were to know what really happened, and I've always thought it probably was a leak from the lab, isn't this really crucial for further safety? I mean, how can we, in the future, stop this from happening again if we never find out how it started in the first place?
Exactly. That's the entire point. I mean, our world has been shut down. Look at us. We're sitting here with masks. Some people haven't come. We're locked into Australia. People have lost loved ones. How many is it now? 3.7 million people have died. I mean, and this is a virus that, what's the fatality rate, Aaron? It's like 1 or 2%? What is it? 1%? You know, if this was a leak from a lab, then... This is such an important issue because the biosafety standards of laboratories globally, you know, would need to be subject to serious review. And by the way, don't forget something Chris Mitchell first pointed out in his column in The Australian. There was already a SARS coronavirus leak in a Beijing lab in 2004. that luckily was contained, one person died and eight people were infected. But this is not the first time this has happened in China, that coronavirus has leaked from a laboratory. And there's a strong history of lab leaks everywhere, you know, even in Australia, that there's been one of a bacterial pathogen at the CSIRO. That was something that Dennis Richardson first told me last year in an interview I did with him for Sky. In any case, laboratory leaks are common. We need to know if it was a lab leak to prevent a future pandemic. And then again, if it was a result of gain-of-function experiments, then we would be calling for an absolute ban on gain-of-function experiments, as like the Obama administration already implemented in 2014, you know, that Fauci lifted under Trump in 2017. If this was a leak of a gain-of-function experiment, then we would be 100%, everyone around the world would be saying, that is enough, scientists, you cannot do gain-of-function experiments anymore. Did you guys watch, what was that comedian last week who did that great?
Stewart.
John Stewart.
I mean, he ended that clip by saying, you know, scientists will be the end of us. Someone in a lab will be saying, oh, just let's see what happens with this. You know, we need to know. We absolutely need to know. And I believe we will know. I think every day there is more information. Even just me as a journalist, I keep finding out more information. So you and I don't have access to metadata and signals data like the agencies do. So I wish. So I do think we will know.
Second last quick question.
Shari, do you, in your book, talk much at all about whether this thing could have started in a wet market in Wuhan, because that was the narrative quite early on, of course, and that was propagated by China and so many others in support of them, perhaps. But I recall our own Prime Minister on that issue demanding that wet markets be shut down, that China, you know, totally get rid of this way of, you know, dealing with animals and animal products and things like that. Do you
I have a
source of this or?
I cover it insofar as why it wasn't the source of it. So wet markets are unhygienic, and potentially there is, you know, reason that they shouldn't exist. I don't know, but perhaps the Prime Minister was right in any case to call for their closure. But in this particular instance, the Chinese health officials admitted publicly in May and June last year, this is George F. Gao, he's the head of China's CDC, he said publicly the wet market was not the source of the outbreak, but it played a role in amplifying the virus. And that's because they took, well, firstly, they completely bleached the wet market on January 1st last year, just a day after they involuntarily had to notify the World Health Organization because word got out of the virus. January 1st last year, they bleached and disinfected the wet market so that no proper samples could be taken. However, the samples that were taken from animals and stalls that had, you know, that they did take, found that the virus was consistent with the virus that had been on humans, which led the Chinese CDC official to say that it was an amplifying factor, not the original source of the outbreak. Of course, it's worth noting the fact, you know, the what we were told, that there were bats there, that was a lie. There were no bats sold or butchered at this wet market in any case. So
just a final question, because we're right on time. International interest in your work, just tell us briefly about that and what's next.
There has been international interest in the work. I mean, it's nice to see, I suppose, that you write a story in The Australian and then outlets around the world are following it up, particularly one revelation I had recently, which was from the book, but I got scared. I'm a newspaper journalist. I'm not used to holding something until late September. So I got scared someone else would find it out, and I put it on the front page, which is that China had developed a vaccine for COVID-19 in February 2020. I got the vaccine patent. And Liam helped me with that research. So I published that. That story was picked up. Well, all of the stories are being picked up internationally. And part of the reason is that, you know, not many journalists have been investigating this because it was a political issue, because it went against the grain. They were seen as conspiracy theorists. So there are, you know, a handful of people internationally, journalists, who've been looking at this and covering it since early last year. And as well as scientists and researchers who form part of this group called Drastic. And I've made a lot of new friends that I've never met before, and we all, you know, speak on Twitter DM and WhatsApp, and it's, so it's a really nice community of people who are investigating this topic. By the way, with no predetermined outcome, you know, no one says it's definitely this or it's definitely this, and everyone's just interested in new evidence that emerges. And this group has arisen, this, you know, this community and connections have arisen because our governments were not taking it seriously and our scientists weren't taking it seriously, and there was no active investigation. So it meant that other people have stepped in to bring a lot of these really important elements to light. And everyone kind of builds on each other's work. So it's been a very enjoyable, rewarding, you know, experience as a journalist. Even though you get attacked as well.
Not here, many thanks.
Not here.
So many thanks to Sherry Markson as we said earlier, we'll be selling copies of what really happened in Wuhan, and you can order them now, and people online can get in touch with us. But I'll be very brief. Without question, this is one of the big stories of the 21st century, and it's great to know that an Australian journalist in News Corp publications and on Sky News has been in the forefront of breaking this story without any reaching conclusions, just asking questions that ought to be asked. And it's terrific that Cherie was here tonight.
We'll have Sherry back when
we're having an interjection now from the floor, but it's great that we've had Sherry here tonight. And as Anne's interjected from the floor, we'd love to have her back later on. But for tonight, well done and congratulations.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.